ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. I'm David Maher. It's December, summer looms. It was 34 in Adelaide today, 37 in Sydney tomorrow, and it's going to be hotter and hotter across the land in the weeks ahead, and we haven't even begun our Christmas shopping. But we know from long experience at Late Night Live that all these chores, the heat and the celebrations ahead, are easier to bear once we get the old year out of our system, and that's the task ahead. For that task, I've handpicked a unique team that's joined me in the studio. Laura Tingle, who for God knows how many years has been the voice of good sense on this show. Laura, welcome.
Hello, David. It's nice to be back.
Hannah Ferguson, 27, who is listened to on social media, Instagram, TikTok, her podcasts, by more people than listen to Late Night Live, it has to be said, by a factor of about three. Hannah, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. It's great to engage with a different audience.
But you have promised to bring your audience to us.
We're doing a swap.
That was the deal.
And we shook hands.
Yes, we shook hands on it. And Craig Rucastle, comedian, irritant, a very bright boy who leapt from the Chaser team to presenting ABC Radio in Sydney in the mornings, breakfast radio in Sydney. You can see his face on the back of buses all over the town. Craig, welcome.
Good to be here. Good to be here.
Now, all I can promise to do is to try to keep this team under control.
We were told to keep you under control.
Yeah, I want my money back.
Have you been briefed behind my back?
Of course.
I suppose my team is professional. Now, Craig, are we as a nation better off at the end of the year than we were at the beginning?
It's a very expensive country to live in. It's very expensive to live in Sydney. I currently have three 20-year-olds living at home with me, and I can't see that ending pretty much any time soon. So it's a shame. It's a very.
Are you renting out rooms?
No, these are my children. These are my children. I did like, though, that it was very useful because the Sydney Morning Herald today published a story that said, Sydney suburbs where you should have bought a house a year ago. Isn't that useful? Thank you very much, Sydney Morning Herald. Useful journalism.
Breaking news.
Yes. I'm sure they're going to follow it up with Sydney suburbs where you should have bought a house 10 years ago, anywhere. But look, are we better off at the end of this year? I don't know.
Hannah, are we better off now than we were 12 months ago?
I think we have more certainty at the end of this year. I think going into January of this year, Donald Trump had just been elected in the US. We were staring down a federal election and it felt uncertain here and abroad. I think at the end of the year, whether we're better off is a different question to whether I feel more certain about where we're heading at least. And I think that gives me a better sense of where we might be going to, even if I'm not confident in the decisions being made.
Where are we heading?
I think we're heading to a worse period in terms of home ownership for my generation, for climate action for my generation, but I am overall glad that we don't have a coalition government at the helm right now as well.
Were you thrilled by the photographs of the blockade in Newcastle Harbour?
I was thrilled, actually. I was thrilled by the week, and I thought that was a great experience for a lot of young people to get out there and make some serious change and make some serious noise.
Not just young people. I mean, an old colleague of mine was arrested.
But I also think that protest movements are coming back in popularity for young people.
Ah,
yeah,
protest is coming back.
Yes.
Why?
Because people are angry. We can't afford the cost of living right now, and young people are feeling the burden that we will not be better off than our parents for the first generation ever, I believe. So I think that there's a level of anger and there's a spirited nature to that. And I think that that is exciting, that there's tangible action being taken rather than just all of us focusing on social media as well.
Is that anger directed at the whole political establishment?
Yes, absolutely. It's directed at the two-party system right now.
And that anger is therefore being expressed by people, what, going green, going Pauline, independence?
I think it's Greens and Independence. I mean, in the federal election, we didn't really see the Greens have an uptick. So I would actually say the Independents...
lost seats, yeah.
Well, actually, no, they remained equal because Zoe Daniel lost her seat, but Nicolette Bowle regained. So that ended up equal. But in terms... Oh, sorry, for the Greens, yes. For the Independents, they're
the
same.
Yeah, I'm saying that the Greens lost seats, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, the Greens in the Senate still strong, but the Independents, I think the next election will really be the tell if their power is to grow or they're going to stay the same.
Have the young lost their natural respect and sympathy for old people, boomers, people who own houses and have superannuation tax breaks?
Yes, I think that there is a generational divide that is causing a lot of hefty emotion. But I also think young people are directing that anger at each other based on whether their parents and grandparents have money versus actually directing it at the older, if that makes sense. Mm.
Well, I mean, this is the problem. I have three of these people obviously against me in my household. I've got to get rid of them. They're opposed to my generation.
Yeah, no, it's us looking at our friends who have parents that can fork out $100,000 when my parents will not be able to, and seeing the sort of feeling the burn of the gap in our friendship groups between who will be able to buy a home and who won't.
Wow, it's that old word expectations coming back again.
But finally, after so many years, Australia has a class system. It's good to see. I mean, the English settled us. We just didn't have a class system.
We didn't appreciate
now.
It.
Yeah, jeez.
Jeez, Craig, you're really on the ball. Getting up at 3:30 a.m. morning after morning has really sharpened your mind. Laura Tingle, are we better off now than we were a year ago?
Look, I think there are a couple of things, partly based on what Craig and Hannah are saying here. One of them is at the beginning of the year, everything was a cost of living, cost of living, cost of living, which is a legitimate issue. But there was so much noise around that that it did sort of tend to confuse and mask those underlying equity issues. Now, issues like housing, like education, like health, these are issues that affect young people in particular. And it's a debate we have got to have. And I think we are better off in this sense, that I think we are getting to a point where those issues cannot be shoved under the carpet much longer.
But Laura, haven't we been saying that for years and years? Oh, we've got to face this. No, it's time that we talked about this.
But absolutely. I remember, because I've changed jobs and they were having a productivity roundtable, you cannot believe my relief. My relief that...
You were in Berlin or Washington or somewhere.
I didn't have to think about a productivity roundtable. I didn't have to hear the word reform one more time, you know, twitch, twitch. But I think the conjunction of events, you know, it's always the conjunction of events and the tides of men and all that stuff that combine. And essentially, what did we see in this last election campaign? We saw the rise of young voters, where suddenly everybody went, oh, gosh, it's young people. Whereas essentially the coalition in particular has basically been fawning to old people for 20 or 30 years. John Howard stashed billions of dollars into the pockets of baby boomers. That's now not a political positive. So the politics has changed and the political structures have changed, because the coalition, you know, as representatives of that particular political strategy, whatever their other issues are, basically made themselves pretty irrelevant. We have now got the big question, as Hannah says, of what happens to the independents? Where do they go next? But, you know, the pressure or the sort of noise for change is coming from people like Allegra Spender. So I think this poses a big issue, as do the budget issues, which are now, they've also been sort of put off for this year because of the election campaign. That's all coming home to roost. So I think there are immense pressures there which will force the government to go into the next election campaign promising reforms in its third term. And I would also say that they're not as frightened of doing that as they were in 2022. Or even in as 2025, but they're not being brave.
They couldn't have more political capital than they have now.
Or less political courage, yes.
It's weird though, because you kind of say that, you know, they're having to answer these questions, that Gen Z's had a big influence, that young people's issues that they care are coming to the fore. And then we see the coalition currently debating getting rid of, you know, no more net zero. It's an amazing response, given that was the kind of underlying texture of the election.
Yeah, it's truly extraordinary that, you know, they really haven't read the room, as they say. But, if one reads, shameless plug for a friend's book, but Nikki Sava's book,
yes,
given the absolute incompetence and lack of policy and understanding of things, you know, to say, oh, well, our polling was bad. Well, you know, why do you have to have the polling telling you that this is a bad idea? But, you know, they had no policies and they are now having a debate about something which is essentially irrelevant anyway. Net zero, you know, the momentum towards green energy or not is happening or isn't happening because it's now in the corporate interests to head that way.
Hannah, we are warned, we have fair warning, that the opposition is going to stack on a big debate about immigration. And presumably that's going to be the opposition discourse early next year. What do young voters think about immigration? Are they perturbed by immigration? Are they worried by this supposed mass immigration?
I mean, we could see the start of this conversation really with the neo-Nazi anti-immigration protests that emerged in the last few months of this year from about September onwards. And young people really cared because there was a massive debate on social media, but the way that it was framed was entirely problematic in that it's really difficult to know how the mainstream media positions an issue in the public square that is really a fringe group extreme issue as well. So how much airtime should we give this? How should we talk about it as young people? And are we just actually inflaming the issue by continually pushing out the relevance of a very small group of extreme minds? So I think there's a central issue as to how it should be reported on and how we should discuss it in the public square. But I think it's to be expected. The Coalition and One Nation right now are in a race to the bottom. They are fighting for a group of voters. They're competing for those voters, but they are a small portion of Australians. And I think we need to remember that when we're having this conversation. And I think this is yet another example of the Coalition going for issues that are not the centrepiece of relevance at all. If they're going to fight over net zero and immigration, I think it's going to be based in mis and disinformation where they're trying to convince people that immigration is the source of many of our issues when actually we need immigration as a country to thrive. And the numbers can be debated, but that's not really what's happening with these rallies and with the Coalition's discussion. They're thinly veiling racism. They're dog whistling to racists because they're trying to gain that voter base from One Nation.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Hannah Ferguson, Laura Tingle and Craig Rucastle about 2025. It does have to be said, though, that the Nazis do visuals really well. Mm. I mean, that demo outside New South Wales Parliament, horrible scene, but the visuals carried everywhere.
Absolutely, but you've also got a large portion of the Australian media landscape, the mainstream media landscape, pandering to the right in that they are publishing full speeches, they are publishing imagery, they are actually promoting them and platforming them and amplifying them beyond what is necessary for just general publication of what's happening around Australia. And when there is, this is often groups of up to 1,000 people, but there are other protests with a turnout of more than 100,000 that are barely gaining the same traction, you've got to wonder. I think the imagery is powerful, they're being successful through those mechanisms, but the attendance isn't that high. The relevance of this conversation isn't that high.
No, it was a small demonstration, but it was choreographed in a way that gave it big impact.
Yes and no, because there had previously been a similar demonstration by the neo-Nazis in front of Parliament and it got no coverage. The coverage really came from the fact that the police had not tried to stop it and the government didn't know about it. Like there was, you know, we were all shocked to know, hang on a second, they did this a few months ago?
It was staggering.
Yeah, so I don't know if it was necessarily the genius of their protest that led to that coverage.
Mm. What was the silliest thing you've seen in politics in Australia this year? I'm going to be putting this question to the whole panel. Craig?
It's an interesting one. You know what we forget? The election was a lot of fun. I mean, we forget that there was a party called the Trumpet of Patriots.
Oh!
I mean, remember that? Remember that wild moment? Remember that was perceived to be a good idea briefly, to call them the Trumpet of Patriots?
And it wasn't cheap.
No. It was a very expensive party as well. I think, I mean, it's kind of ironic in a way that one of the big mess-ups of the political campaign was Peter Dutton and the suggestion that you know, everyone should come back into the office. And in the end, all of his local electors decided maybe you should go back into the office. And ironically, he's now working from home. So it's, what an own goal.
Laura, silliest sight. I, of course, have something to nominate myself. But Laura?
Look, I think, once again, a lot of it revolves around Peter Dutton and the definition of silly. But the moments I always quite like are when somebody's doing something and you can see somebody in the background with a sort of, yeah, that's great. Yeah. And so I'm thinking Jacinta Nampajimpa Price talking about making Australia great again, and Dutton in the background going, oh, yeah, that's great.
Hey, hey, just for fun, let's hear that again.
And we have incredible candidates right around the country that I'm so proud to be able to stand beside and to ensure that we can make Australia great again, that we can bring Australia back to its former glory, that we can get Australia back on track.
Genius.
Great. Well, it's interesting because the Liberal Party's currently done their examination into why they lost the election. I presume that's in there. I want to just put a call out to them because at the moment they're debating whether or not to put out the embarrassing parts or whether.
Yes.
On behalf of everyone, can I say please put out the
yes,
embarrassing
please.
Parts?
Come on.
Without that,
fair
there's, no, there's no point in doing this. We all knew that Trump was a factor. We knew that kind of stuff. He didn't need to do this.
Well, apparently they didn't for some time. No. I mean, this is the.
Really?
Look, this is the perplexing thing. I mean, it was regarded as the worst day in the campaign in terms of visuals. But to me, the weirdest thing about politics, which is not a question you've asked, but now that I've mentioned
silly,
it.
Silly, weird.
is what emerges about Peter Dutton, which is in the entire time he was leader of the opposition and David Littleproud was leader of the coalition partner, the Nationals, they never had a meal together. They never had a coffee together. They never had any sort of social interaction in 3 years.
Yeah, that's in Nicky's book, isn't it?
That's in Nicky's book.
Was there no sandwich press in the office? What's going on?
No sandwich press. But beyond that, he didn't talk to his deputy. He didn't talk to his shadow cabinet. Oh, yeah. His media advisor didn't talk to the media. Now, we're starting to see a pattern here, right? And you're thinking. And he didn't like to work on weekends. I mean,
and he didn't like being interviewed.
And he didn't like being interviewed. He didn't actually like talking to anybody. Why would you want to be prime minister? I mean, I think it was just one of those things where he'd sort of got on this path and he hadn't actually sort of thought through the consequences.
Well, it's actually
quite a serious point. Like, why?
No. It was weird.
Yeah, in Nikki's book, she talks about the fact that, like, he was operating to 80% at all times and the fact that, like, there was a lot of people that just said his heart wasn't really in it. He didn't really want the job. He was just sort of thrust there and then decided he had to win.
But he thrust himself. You know, this is very...
Can I just point out for balance sake that there was some strangeness from Albo.
For the ABC?
Exactly. we forget this too. Remember Albo fell off a stage on camera in front of everyone.
No, he didn't fall.
No, he had one foot on the ground.
He then debated for ages about the fact that I didn't fall.
It was a misstep.
A misstep, yes. What a wild thing.
Do you know
thing.
What it reminded me of? The old Hollywood code, I think it was before the war, maybe a little bit into the 1950s, where couples canoodling on a bed, one of them had to have a foot on the ground, which somehow indicated to the audience that this was a moral situation. I don't know how. Albo had a foot on the ground.
We had a foot on the ground, but it always reminds me of back in the day when during the 96 election campaign and John Howard fell down a flight of stairs and like it was actually excruciating to watch you because you could almost hear his ankle crack and he sort of gets himself up and no, it's all fine. But the very cruel thing was he went on and won the election, so hurrah. But I remember just travelling around with him for some months afterwards with the wonderfully disreputable Michael Bowers, and every time there was a flight of stairs, all the cameramen and photographers would scurry across to the bottom of the stairs waiting for him
to get that shot.
Disgraceful, disgraceful.
But really, I know it's outside Australia, but the escalators that didn't work for Donald Trump, heaven. Just heaven.
Just delicious.
But now, Craig, you
Global
mentioned...
conspiracy, I think is what you're saying. United Nations conspiracy.
An escalator conspiracy.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned it, so I'm coming back to it, the sandwich press. Now, surely that was one of the great sights of 2025. In fact, 1925 of the century.
Extraordinary. Our politicians.
The size of the stakes.
The stakes were gigantic. I mean, it got a lot of attention. It hasn't got Barnaby over the line yet, though. Maybe if she, put in a barbecue or something, it would have been better.
You know those stories that appear in The Guardian quite often about blind dates? And both sides of a blind date report in about how they went.
Yes.
It looked a bit like that, loved her steak. Hannah, the sight of three Wagyu steaks cooking on a sandwich press must surely appeal to these people I call young people because they've had to live like this. They've had to cook
with
Wagyu.
With the Wagyu.
Yes.
It's all Wagyu for the young people now.
And all I find myself doing on a Wednesday night is three Wagyus on the sandwich press. I love that that's the idea. We would be buying Wagyu but not an oven. Or a fry pan. I think that's fantastic. I mean, it's air fryers nowadays for us too. Not the toasty sort of over.
What is an air fryer? Does it...
I'm amazed you know what a sandwich press is, because in the ABC in the ABC building, sandwich presses were considered extremely dangerous for many years. Mm. They were outruled in the ABC building.
Really?
And there was one secret one in Triple J. And even after I left Triple J, for years I'd go back to Triple J just to toast my sandwich, because it was the only place that got away with it.
But now look, we were unable to get any commentary from Pauline about cooking on the sandwich press. But we were able to dig up some wonderful comments on cooking at a sausage sizzle during, I think, the election campaign.
No worries. Do you want to prick them first? I love pricking a few.
I'm imagining we do this, we're going to get some fat spitting in our faces.
I've had more than fat spit in my face.
Yes, well, the silence that greeted that commentary out there is being matched by the silence greeting the tape in here.
Tape. You're so sweet.
See, he doesn't know a sandwich presses. Tape. Doesn't know digital here.
Baffled by air fryers.
Yeah.
Now, look, I will bring up, if you're not very careful, I will bring in up how hurt you were, Laura Tingle,
by all of
those people this year saying, were you there in Canberra on 11th of November 1975?
I wasn't pleased, I have to say. I was in Mrs. Small's maths class. And she had very big flares and platform shoes, which dates a little bit.
And what were her words when she came into the classroom, and was she pale?
Look, she came in and said, oh, the government's just been sacked, and started a conversation about, I think my recollection was it was very balanced. She sort of said, look, this has happened, and didn't get right into the details of it, but she said, but it's now going to the people, and the people will be able to decide, which I've got to say was generally the message from the November 11th conference in Canberra on November 11th, which was the coalition kept saying, oh, well, don't worry about that. It went to the election and we won, which, you know, 50 years on seems to sort of still remain a fairly narrow way of viewing those events.
What was this year the silliest thing brought into Parliament? Hannah?
I mean, Sarah Hanson-Young bringing the salmon was pretty good.
No.
Also the Senate, sorry.
Oh, sorry, yes, you're right.
Yeah,
it was
the
Sarah
salmon.
Hanson-Young, the
yeah,
salmon.
Yeah.
And it was cling-wrapped or something, wasn't it? It wasn't dripping on the red carpet.
I think it had a cling-wrap around it. Yeah, I think there was a safety from the smell.
Mm. Right.
Mm. I mean, the burqa again.
Gosh. Yes, yeah.
Even my children just went, hasn't she already done this? It was just like the same gag again.
There is that old expression, one-trick pony, that comes to mind. Yes. Laura, can you think of...
No, the burqa was demeaning and... for everybody involved, and ridiculous, and apart from anything else, you know, she'd done it once before, but she's supposed to be riding the wave of popularity. But if that's the case, why does she have to do something which is so attention seeking? You know, but the first time she did it, this was sort of at the centre of the debate, but it's not now. So it just looked rather tired,
but also nasty.
Of course it's nasty.
Nasty.
Completely.
Not appealing. But talking about nasty, this I thought was one of my most uncomfortable moments of the year, when the Nine reporter Josh Bavis asked Katter about his family. So Katter is talking about all the people he wants to turf out of Australia, and Channel 9 reporter says, but, you know, aren't your folk Lebanese?
Oh, mate, don't say that, because that irritates me, and I punch blokes in the mouth for saying that. Don't you dare say that. My family have been in this country for 140 years, right? And if you say anything like that, I have on many occasions punched blokes in the mouth, right? So I'm restraining myself today. Don't say it.
Laura, you know Katter. What on earth is going on there?
Look, there have been all sorts of explanations about his sensitivity, about his mother and his father and all those sorts of things, but I just thought I'm very... fond of Bob Katter. He's, you know, a colourful person in the parliament, and, you know, has a wide range of views. But I just thought, oh, Bob, it's probably time to get out now, because it just seemed so completely disproportionate and out of control.
Yeah, but he's still proud of it. He was talking about it the other day. He was bringing it up and proud of it.
Yeah, he quotes it.
I know. But it doesn't make sense to me.
Carter is interesting to me because, you know, despite the wide range of views that he holds, and a lot of them actually quite extreme and conservative, he has a lot of popularity with young people across the political spectrum too, because we see him as like a caricature of Australia.
Well, I think there's also an authenticity about him. He is who he is, and he's sort of the absolute opposite of the plain bred white politician. And
yeah, but I think there's a level of kind of the way and the reason we're able to find him funny is because he's sort of dismissed it as unserious, whereas Pauline Hanson, as the female version of a Bob Catter, in many ways similar views, I would suggest too, a lot of overlap, would be demonised by a lot of young women who are progressive as well. So I find it quite interesting, the double standard of how we view Bob Catter's views and how he's kind of dismissed as the funny, authentic figure.
But is it partly because he's seen as... what's the word? Not quarantined, but I mean, Bob has this massive following in his own electorate, but he's never been at risk of that expanding into, you know, more representation.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that is part of the reason, but I did find it interesting how the rhetoric changed last year when the Catter Party in Queensland kind of had a bigger conversation about reproductive rights and how that almost contextualised them as a more serious threat to how we see Australia and a modern Australia as well, which makes him an interesting figure still, even though I disagree with almost all of his views.
He's got quite a following in the gay community because of that magnificent statement he made at the time of the gay marriage debate. The gay marriage debate didn't worry him when every month in Queensland somebody's eaten by a croc.
May a thousand blossoms bloom.
Yeah. didn't come across as being massively pro the gay community.
No.
He was on the fence.
I suppose having watched him in Parliament for years, like you sort of, okay, Bob's getting up to ask a question, concentrate. And there'll be these rambling questions, you know, and it's basically incoherent and it's not even necessarily offensive, but like he has so many positions on so many weird issues that I tend to sort of just cauterize it and go, well, that's just Bob. And I think that's the way
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, and I'm talking to Laura Tingle, Craig Rucastle and Hannah Ferguson about 2025. Hannah, language in 2025. What's language doing?
Oh, a lot around AI at the moment. When we're talking about like the words of the year, a lot of it is to do with like AI slop. The word clanker was big this year. It was essentially a derogatory term for a robot or AI thing.
Never heard it.
Really interesting. It was in the top 10 for some.
Clanker.
Clanker is like a sort of offensive term for a robot or AI kind of thing. There's just a lot to do with the 6-7, but that's always on trend for Gen Z. There's always a word that we're trying to evade the meaning from people older than us. But I think really the dominant sort
of... You mean hide the meaning?
Yes.
I'm also told that punctuation is dying out amongst the young, that the comma is almost unknown and the full stop is a stranger in texts.
Oh, the comma and the Oxford comma, they have important places in my heart. I'm not letting them go anytime soon. I think what is going is the M dash, though, because people are picking up on the fact that ChatGPT uses the M dash in excess, and now it's being presumed that if you have too many M dashes, you have a ChatGPT usage issue.
Yes.
Okay. Come on, somebody.
I was going to say you have to come to Late Night Live to learn that. If you want to make your text look authentic, man-made, as it were, or person-made, I suppose we should say, don't use M-dashes.
This is it. My son got trouble with this because he likes an M-dash and he was like, well, now they think it's AI.
I never liked it, to be honest. I was never using it. In fact, that's why I knew that ChatGPT was so obvious because suddenly all my friends had them.
I was once reproached by Gough Whitlam for using too many M-dashes in the text of a book I'd written. The dash, he said, is a point of rhetoric, not punctuation.
I love that story. That's
great. I love what I do love the AI slop stories that come out. Like, for instance, Deloitte being busted for using AI on one of their big government reports and then having to hand back part of the $400,000
that was paid excellent.
For. Was just chef's kiss. What a wonderful moment for the year. That was beautiful.
And chef's kiss. That's the first time I've heard that.
Chef's kiss. That's exactly it.
Yes.
Okay.
Instead of doing it, you just say chef's kiss. Everyone will get it. Young people will love it. Try it out today.
Hey, Hannah, what are the words we can no longer use in 2025?
I actually think there's been an interesting discussion this year around the weaponization of the word woke and the use of the word influencer in relation to the federal election too. They've been some quite fascinating topics where the culture wars and a lot of the language of progression has been used by the right-wing media against young people and sort of kept us down and our arguments down by labelling us as woke, anything that asks for better. I think there's some interesting things around that kind of language in the political sphere as well.
Is it working as abuse?
I mean, yeah, it has a hurtful effect. I think it is harmful to call anything that's asking for more from the government as woke. I think that's pretty damaging rhetoric.
Mm. Laura, you get that feeling? Or is that Trumpian?
It's pretty Trumpian. I suppose I'm sort of interested in a longer term sense in how it moved from the chattering classes. This is quite a long time ago too. Mm. You know, there's been various things. You know, there's nothing worse than being part of the chattering class. Just ask one of the members of the chattering classes from The Australian who was complaining about all the other members of the chattering classes who weren't from The Australian. I just remember Paddy McGuinness was always going on about the chattering classes, which was fairly ironic since he was actually a professional chattering class. But when you think about it, you just think, and that was a sort of a Republican Party phrase that we imported, just like woke. But if you think about how that's just morphed in terms of all the implications of, you know, daring to sort of be talking about an issue into now there are just issues that, you know, are just beyond the pale that you can't talk about. I think, you know, with political correctness sort of in the middle of that. I mean, to me, woke is just another version of politically correct. And
or so, chattering or elite. Remember elite?
Or elites, yes.
Yes. Yes. You can have elite sportsmen, but yeah, you can't have elites. Is that right, Craig?
I think that's right, yes. I must admit, I can't think of any words that can or can't be said. I don't think of that on a daily basis. And I think generally the people who are complaining about this are people who are complaining with a national platform and telling people they've been silenced. So I don't know.
Yes, but let me slightly shift the question. It strikes me that there are political issues in the woke area which no longer have any impact. And I wonder, Hannah, is it worthwhile anybody in Australia these days trying to put the boot into transsexuals? Or is that over?
I think that the conversation has become ripened again because of the Trump administration. Again, it's very easy for the far right in Australia to just continue to import the same discussions that are happening in the far right in the US and believing that will be successful. I think that when we're having these conversations, we need to be sensitive. I think there are a lot of people in Australia who have genuine questions about, you know, what it means to be transgender in Australia, but we should be directing them sensitively and appropriately to members of the transgender community rather than being accusatory or harmful in the language. So I think the ask is to be sensitive and considerate rather than to never ask a question or never be open to conversation. I think there's a belief from a lot of people who ironically want to claim that the left are snowflakes who are defensive, that believe that they're being attacked and silenced just because they're being asked to be considerate of human feelings and experiences as well.
I don't think that's going to be in the past at all. I think it's still going to be a political football. We've just seen laws changed in Queensland to try and, you know, reduce the accessibility to certain surgeries from people who are transgender. I can't see that being in the past.
Still on the boil.
I think it does create issues for how we cover these issues because it is seen purely too often as just a cultural issue, whereas, you know, there are all sorts of complex questions that it generates, and it's almost impossible to have, well, one, a conversation, but two, to actually just, you know, sort of have put information out there without it sort of conjuring up imputations. So I think it has become something that's really difficult to talk about.
What about the power of anti-Semitism, the accusation of anti-Semitism to silence public criticism of Israel? Has that lost its punch, do you think?
I think it's become better informed, shall we say, that it's harder to just say that anything that you say criticising the Israeli Prime Minister or the Israeli government is anti-Semitic. I think the sort of sense that you had to be very careful about what you said, lest it be seen as anti-Semitic when it was just a criticism of the government of Israel, has sort of lessened. So I think the devastation in Gaza has changed that equation quite considerably.
Craig, what's the feeling when you're doing talkback? Are you getting people complaining to you that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic and has to stop?
Not really. I must admit, I think on local radio and Sydney radio, generally speaking, people are a little bit over talk about that issue. I mean, it becomes when it comes to Sydney and when it becomes, you know, March Across the Bridge, there's a lot of passionate discussion about it. But you don't get a lot of people calling up on a daily basis talking about that issue, to be honest.
I mean, it was one of the biggest topics across social platforms this year. And when it came to podcasts, it was too, because it was a space where different conversations could be had, especially on where a lot of media platforms, legacy media platforms, were failing. And I think that the online space was a place where different language could be used, more serious, severe language to describe, you know, the genocide happening against Palestinians. And naming this and calling it out and critiquing legacy media was a really strong space for social media. And, you know, that exists across a spectrum of quality and accuracy as well. But I think social media was the place a lot of people turned when they felt failed by the outlets they had once subscribed to.
But in a way, it's interesting because social media, it tends to be more divided. So it is, you know, you've got your left-wing podcast. You call yourself a progressive left-wing media organisation. You have your right-wing podcast and that. So people who wanted to just have their opinion filled and reinforced obviously went to those particular areas, depending on which side they're on. Mainstream media, particularly the ABC, has certain editorial guidelines which make it a lot harder to just be shouting out from one side. I, for one, to be honest, I think the coverage of the Gaza war from, you know, John Lyons and Matthew Doran and that kind of, all of the ABC correspondents has
Laura
been incredible.
Tingle. And Laura Tingle.
I know, she's in the room. I'm not going to do what she's here. has been extraordinary, and I've been extremely angry to watch some of the kind of criticism come in. And I'm not normally defensive for the ABC, but I've kind of gone, I watch some of those reports and go, you are dealing with such an incredibly complex situation. You can't get into Gaza, you're stuck in Israel, and they would bring so much depth and both sides of the story to it that I was just angered by this kind of criticism as if it was not being done properly.
I think Matthew and Eric Torchek have just, and the team in, have just done an extraordinary job.
I agree.
Which brings us to Antoinette Latouf. Laura, where do you think the ABC is post that humiliating defeat in the courts on the Antoinette Latouf case?
At which point I have to make the declaration, David, that I'm a member of the ABC board.
Indeed, I had not forgotten that. somehow it sits on your shoulders.
It sits on my shoulders, yes.
Should we first say that the Antoinette Latouf case was a case of improper dismissal brought by Antoinette Latouf after she was fired by the ABC?
So being on the board, I am partially constrained in what I can say, board confidentiality and everything, but I'd make a couple of observations. The first one, just for the record, because there is mischievous suggestion abroad, the court documents, so I'm not breaking any board confidentiality here, but the court documents show that the board was not involved in sacking Antoinette Latouf. Furthermore, the board didn't know about the sacking of Antoinette Latouf and had considerable trouble finding out what had been going on in an official capacity. Now, does the ABC look good out of this? No, it looks terrible. Was it a terrible decision? Yes. I think everybody has basically agreed that it was a complete
to
debacle.
To sack her.
The whole thing has been bad. I would reflect on what has happened since, that it hasn't been a bad outcome for the ABC in this sense, that the court case revealed quite a lot of interesting things about the way the organisation worked, not necessarily of a flattering nature. It gave the whole organisation cause to reflect and review the way it operated, and hopefully to avoid a repeat of such a debacle in the future.
It was clear from the court papers that she was shown the door because of a threat from the Murdoch press to publish a story about this supposed profound critic of Israel. She is a critic of Israel, but that's fine enough, being on the ABC. That she had to go because the Murdoch press was about to attack the ABC. Do you think the Murdoch press still has the power to fashion the decisions made by the ABC?
No. No.
It's also simplistic to say that was the only thing. I mean, there was a lot of input beforehand and a lot of pressure that came to bear, as we saw from, you know, text messages and all that kind of stuff. So that may have been the final step, but yeah.
But just in response to what David's suggesting, which is goes to the bigger point about the cultural cringe that the ABC has had towards News Limited for a very long time, I think that is one of those things that I would refer to. I think that...
As a good outcome for the case.
As a good outcome at terrible cost to both Antoinette Latouf and to the ABC.
$2.6 million in legal fees. Oh,
no. But the point is, I think the combination of that, a change of people at the top of the organisation, and frankly, the federal election campaign have, as somebody who works here, the sense of a shiver looking for a spine to run up, whatever the expression was all those years ago.
Who was that said of?
Peter Walsh said it about Bob Hawke. And I think Hugh Marks is, having come in after it, has sort of learned the lessons of that.
Can I say in my own defence, Craig, that she had to be thrown out of the building without even an exit interview was to beat the...
No, I understand.
There was,
to
be, yeah, there was a long... I don't understand. There was a long brought up there. Does anybody care about the Murdoch press amongst what we call young people?
Only to point out how it's failing. The young people aren't reading the Murdoch press. I mean, actually, that's not fair. Young people still engage and click with on tabloid media. I mean, it's making money from us because it talks about Abby Chatfield in 4,000-sentence-long headlines every second day. So I think that there is relevance in the fact that they are posting through social media and using it quite successfully as a front door to get clicks on their site still. So, yes, there is still relevance, and to deny that, you know, is to deny the fact that a lot of content creators are actually feeding the beast by making inflammatory content that goes against it. I think that should be acknowledged too. But I think actually, you know, Antoinette Latouf's story this year has been one that young people have really picked up on and really spoken to in terms of what journalists can or cannot publish and say on social media. And it's been interesting also from my perspective to see this conversation revolve around sharing political opinion online as a journalist, when the Human Rights Watch post that Antoinette Latouf shared, you know, stated that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. And that doesn't feel like a political opinion to me. That feels like sharing a statement of fact. And it's still interesting, again, to navigate the language of activism and advocacy when you're a journalist. But I think I'm just really proud to be a young woman in media looking up to someone like Antoinette Latouf and what she stood up to and what the ABC was willing to spend in a losing fight against her.
And it should be clear that in posting what she posted, although it... angered many, many people, she did not disobey any direction that she had been given at the ABC.
And I also think one of the most promising parts of the story, one of the most beautiful parts of the story actually, was that what Antoinette Latouf wanted out of this experience was to get a job back at the ABC and for the ABC to be better. It wasn't really a vendetta more than it was a standing up to say, I want improvement here and genuine change.
Can I also just point out, just for balance again, that whilst we say no young people are reading News Limited and all that kind of stuff, they're also not watching the ABC, okay? Just so we know, just so you know, okay?
Good point. Good point.
You've saved us about three savage columns there, but I think Jared Henderson will still have a go at it. I'm sorry, Craig, he will.
It's sad to say.
This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live, David Marr, and I'm talking to Laura Tingle, Craig Rucastle, Hannah Ferguson. Let us look to the departures this year. Who has gone that we are really going to miss? Laura?
Well, David Stratton. We're really going to miss David Stratton. But we've been missing him for quite a while.
Because he hasn't been on the screen.
No, but, you know, it was just that sort of comforting sense of somebody who loved cinema at a time when we sort of don't talk about cinema much anymore. Mm.
And that gorgeous sort of tension between him and Margaret Pomerantz.
And David. Yes,
and David.
Yeah. I went to a European film a few weeks ago, and I was thinking, oh, that's right, cinema. Because we sort of it's all either Marvel or streaming, and to actually just go and you sort of go, look at that cinematography, oh my God, and this is a French film and it's about absolutely nothing, but oh my God, it's so wonderful. So he was a beacon of remembering all of those things.
I disagree, it was a terrible film. The other thing about David Stratton, could I say as on a personal note, was that he was always up for a Chaser cameo. We used him constantly.
Yes.
We would wheel him out for anything and he was always brilliant and wonderful and he would take any joke about himself or anything. anything else. He was so wonderful.
And
he
had such a great sense of humour. And now Margaret is reading those astonishing
scripts. Yes. No, they were both scripts. Wonderful.
They're both, you know what they were, show-offs, the pair of them. Hannah, who's gone with that we're going to miss?
I'm so sorry to say, like, I was thinking about this, and yes, there are people like John Laws who've also died this year, but as a Gen Z in the room, I'm not particularly familiar with a lot of the people that we know are the big people that have died this year. I'm not familiar with their work.
Can I say to you, can I comfort you by saying that you mustn't be apologetic about that, because people in the media die twice. They die when they leave the screen or leave the microphone. Then years later, they die again. And people have almost forgotten them by then. But John Laws was remembered, both for his golden tonsils and for his grubby proclivity to take money.
I think you may have helped reveal.
What's that?
I think you may have helped reveal that David Marr.
Oh, no. The revealer was Richard Ackland.
Yes.
I was on the scene when there was a commission of inquiry into Cash for Comment, and oh, God, it was fun.
It is sad, though, with his passing, that I guess we'll never really get to know what his true position and true feeling about banks was.
Yes, because, you know, one week they were just vultures and the next week they were lovely people.
We'll never know what he truly felt now. Yes.
And are we allowed to talk about people who we won't necessarily miss?
Yes. Oh, you're a professional and you're moving me on to my next question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I've got to say I was quite gobsmacked by the hagiographies when Graham Richardson left us. Now, he was obviously a very big figure in Labor politics, but I'm going to just, if you indulge me, I'm going to quote Kate McClymont on Graham Richardson.
Kate McClymont, one of the great journalists in this country, writing for Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, who brings such gorgeous touch to squalor.
There were the bribes paid to him by way of prostitutes, offset Alpine, Swiss bank accounts taking a cut of the political donations he collected, accepting a hefty payment from Eddie Obeid in return for getting Obeid into Parliament, having a major property developer build the extension on his home, being on the payroll of developers, and so much more. Now, of course, that didn't mention some of the controversies in which he was embroiled, I'm sure, at the margins, David Marr, such as the bashing of the ALP left Peter Baldwin when Graham Richardson was Secretary of the New South Wales Labor Party, but so much more.
Look, you had to keep the left under control, Laura. Sometimes you bring too high-minded a notion to the way in which politics in New South Wales is conducted.
Yeah, but I believe whatever it takes would be his response.
But to get the other side of Graham Richardson, read the hagiography delivered in Parliament by Richard Marles, who talked about him as a Labor saint. It's just staggering.
The former leader of the Nationals, Michael McCormack, gushed about him on social media.
Laura?
People can be complex figures. They can have good and bad within them. I think he did achieve some good things. I mean, he was actually quite good
for
environmental
laws. Are you speaking
for yourself
here, Craig? He was quite good for environmental laws. An interesting mix of good and bad?
Exactly.
Yes, he saved the Daintree. How long, Hannah, do you think we should wait before telling the truth about the dead?
Look, I don't have a good track record of this.
Why? What happened?
Oh, I wrote something about Charlie Kirk the day he died, and it wasn't received
well on social
media.
You didn't tell the truth, did you? What did you say?
I did tell the truth.
What did you say?
I did say that the social media sort of uproar that occurred that day, we didn't need to make a choice between celebration and condemnation. This was the sort of world he advocated for. I'm not celebrating his death. I'm also not going to grieve. And that was apparently just too much. Something.
Didn't you call for aggression in politics or something?
No,
or something
I didn't. Like no, the AFR did say that I was calling for political violence. They did write a few pieces about that. No, I said that throughout history there have been times when political violence has been necessary to rise up against an oppressor, but this was not an example of that.
Did you quote Julius Caesar, the knifing of Julius Caesar, for instance?
I didn't. Instagram probably wouldn't have been that interested in that, but I did think about it. Thank you for the suggestion. I'll try and implement it next time.
Now, look, we've only got a moment to go, and this is where I know politicians will be listening to us, leading politicians in the country. Where do you think we should send them on holidays this year, Hannah? It's going to be a major bushfire season. The growth out there is astonishing. The burn-off smell is across Australia already.
Well, at least Albanese's in Australia for his honeymoon, we hear. So he's not going to be pulling a Scott Morrison in the immediate future, I hope, and going to Hawaii. But I think, yeah, a domestic holiday is up for the politicians at Christmas. But I would, you know what? I lived in Brisbane for 6 years. I'm a big Queensland girl. I think something, you know, Hamilton Island maybe would be lovely.
I think this is it. Poor Jodie Hayden. She doesn't get to have a honeymoon in France because Scott Morrison went to Hawaii.
I did think that. I did think it's so deeply unfair that she has to sort of settle for whatever they have to do domestically because that's sort of just a bad look now.
Yeah.
But that's professional politics. Laura, where would you recommend as holiday destinations?
I think this is really fraught because, you know, you want to send them somewhere where they've done some damage, but all those places that have done damage don't deserve them. So I think probably going home to their electorates would be quite a good thing to make them do.
And you call me old-fashioned.
We don't know where Alba's gone on honeymoon, do we? Or at least
I think
we haven't
the Cliff House. I think the Cliff House has been rented
out. That's been rented out.
Yeah.
In all seriousness, he's now got to go somewhere very secure. Which is a sad sort of statement on our politics, which was also the case with Peter Dutton, swinging back to that. Mm. I mean, I do wonder whether the fact that he had a 24-hour-a-day police detail literally shadowing him everywhere he went, you know, what sort of impact that had on his family.
Was that noticeable on the campaign that it was a lot more security around politicians?
Well, it was because of his history as a Home Affairs minister, that had been going on for years. But
he can go wherever he likes this year. Hey, are there any rumours about memoirs? Is he writing his memoirs?
I haven't heard anything about
no,
that.
No.
Surely Hannah, not.
Aren't you going to try and write it? You write a good biography?
I'm not going to ghost Peter Dutton's memoirs. Now, we have a minute left. Ladies and gentlemen, 2025, one word. One word. There's a silence across the table, ladies and gentlemen, which is profound. One word. Hannah is grappling with it. Laura has brought her mouth towards the microphone. Have you got the word, Laura?
Insane.
Thank you, Laura. Hannah?
Centrist.
I beg your pardon?
Centrist.
I'll come back to see if you want to have another go. I'm Craig.
I don't know. AI slop, I guess. It's a good summary of the whole year.
AI slop. Hannah, another go, or are you sticking with that?
What are you trying to get away from that? It's great for her to be on the ABC and say centrist. Yeah.
Okay, I'll do it one more time. We'll do it one more time.
Okay, what?
Trump.
Crackerjack. Okay. Crackerjack. We have the year. We have bottled up the year. We have shed the year. You have all confessed. You can leave the cubicle now, sinless and ready for summer. I have been joined for this insightful, sensible discussion by Laura Tingle, ABC Global Affairs editor, Craig Rucastle, these days breakfast presenter, ABC Sydney, and Hannah Ferguson, CEO of Cheek Media, host of Big Small Talk podcast, and because you've told me it's not a pejorative, influencer.
Oh, God. I said young people, was it not influencer?
Yeah, she said influencer was a pejorative, yeah.
It's been such a pleasure to talk 2025 with the lot of you. Thanks. This is Late Night Live. That's the show and the week, so it's Chatterbox time. Now, first, the show's here all summer. We're playing the hits of LNL in 2025, what you've missed and what you're dying to hear again. And while that goes on, the team is taking a bit of a break. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your emails, letters and cards. We learn so much from them. They feed the show. Keep them coming. And all you need to know to contact us is on the Late Night Live website. We're so proud of having far-flung listeners, and the furthest flung still is Jenny in the High Caucasus Mountains of Georgia. But an email the other day from Rome deserves a special mention. I tune in live whenever I can during lunchtime walks or runs around the Eternal City, wrote Damiano. He reports frequent laughter from himself as he jogs along the Tiber, homesick but with Late Night Live connecting him to home. Thanks, Damiano. Can I particularly thank Dale for that group shot of about 30 swimmers at the Kalgoorlie Men's Baths in 1917? What can I say except that 1917 was about a dozen years before the introduction of Speedos. Finally, I would like to report that I have converted at least one Late Night Live listener to Patrick White. My thanks to the team that pulls this show together and pulls me into line. Catherine Zingara, Ali Benton, Alex Tai, Anne Arnold, Sarah Allerley, Rebecca Metcalf, Gail Bosiero, and Helen Pitt. And to our executive producer, Jack Schmidt, who's about to be a father. To Elena Katz-Chernin, again and again and again, our thanks for the Chatterbox rag. Only 4 months old, but it fits us like a glove. As always, till next time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.